Welcome back, Lagos, Nigeria, wherever you're listening from. You heard that. Like, we're going to get Reverend Isaac back. He lives in Bethlehem. So none of you can argue with me anymore, right? You can't argue about me about Palestine is not where Jesus came from. You got it. You get it? He's told you, right? And what he requested, we are going to try and make happen. Nigeria Info will try to get Reverend Isaac with Nigerian theologians and get them talking, because it's time to dispel all these lies and misconceptions that you've all been told. Ah, I'm smiling. Can you hear me? You can literally feel me smiling because I have my Palestinian sister. She's my next guest. Okay. And you know, she doesn't cut it like they do. She cuts it tight and clean. Noor Ode, you must know her by now. Hello, my love. How are you?
Hello, my dear sister. I'm very good. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us again. I'm going to start this conversation with a recording that I'd like you to listen to. Lagos, Nigeria, please listen to it too.
On April 1st, Israel struck a convoy belonging to a U.S. charity, World Central Kitchen. It happened in Gaza, in an area designated by Israel as a safe zone. 7 aid workers, most of them from abroad, were killed. They were delivering food to starving Palestinians. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the attack was unintentional and that this sort of thing happens in war. But our digital investigations team, SANAD, found out what exactly happened. Using satellite imagery, open source information, witness testimony, and pictures taken at the bombing sites, we have created a chronology of events, and the evidence we've found raises serious questions about Israel's military methods. The aid charity said its workers had left a warehouse after delivering 100 tons of food aid. They also say that, for safety, they shared their plans and coordinates with the Israeli army before leaving. World Central Kitchen, WCK for short, confirms that 7 of their relief workers were killed. They were from Australia, Palestine, Poland, and the United Kingdom. One of them was a dual US-Canadian citizen. The driver, Saif Abu Taha from Rafah, was also killed. The first report of the attack by the Israeli military came from journalists at 10:43 p.m. local time on Rashid Street in the Deir al-Balah neighborhood. Local journalists say Israeli forces struck the aid vehicle, causing it to burst into flames. A person who lives in the area told Al Jazeera that there were multiple explosions between 11 and 11:30 p.m.
أسعفوا بعض الجماعة ركبوا بعض في الجيب الثاني شردوا منه وقدام قصفوا الجيب الثاني قدام حتلاقوا كمان جيب مرة.
The second vehicle, which was now carrying the injured, was also hit. According to satellite images, the second aid vehicle was struck around 800 meters from the first. A third vehicle was attacked about 1.6 kilometers from the second. Analysis of pictures taken of the second and third vehicles suggests a projectile penetrated the roof. This suggests the vehicles were hit from above. All this despite clear WCK markings on the vehicle's roofs and windshields. In fact, one projectile basically hit the center of a large WCK logo on the roof.
Clearly something catastrophic has happened. It's not something that we wanted, and we're going to get to the bottom of this and find out exactly what happened.
Netanyahu says such things happen in war, but to get to the bottom of what happened, we wanted to know how, in this war, the Israeli chain of military command works.
So this is all the hallmarks of a drone strike. The
missiles came from the air. The convoy was closely observed.
and each vehicle was separately targeted. So this is a series of drone strikes rather than a single accident, which lends to the theory that an order had been given for this convoy to be destroyed. And unlike a pilot in a manned aircraft, a drone strike has a very different anatomy. So these images the drone is filming will be beamed back to a room that's seen not just by the operator pilot, but also by his or her commanding officer, also by possibly a room full of intelligence analysts, maybe politicians, senior military, be a whole host of people, depending on the operation, than just a single rogue pilot.
And what does this attack mean legally for Israel?
The international law is very clear. The first point is this objective is not a military. So if you have a military objective, it is war. If the objective is civilian, it is a crime. The second is the importance of the arms. You see there is a destruction of the vehicle. Even if it was Palestinian or civilian of a nationality, and it is not to stop the vehicle, it is to exterminate, to kill the persons.
According to the UN, almost 200 aid workers have been killed since Israel's war on Gaza began. The World Central Kitchen is calling on Israel to stop the indiscriminate killing and has now suspended its operations in Gaza, leaving tens of thousands of Palestinians to starve, some to death.
Okay, you all needed to listen to that because I'm not going to take it for granted that you've seen it on the news or you've followed the news, because my guest and I, Nora and I, are going to be talking about this. We're going to start a conversation. If you're watching us on YouTube, please refresh. If you're watching us on Facebook, please refresh. If you want to call 07-100-993-993-993 or the other line, which is 0201-465-7190. But I would prefer that you send your messages or your questions to the WhatsApp on 0809-597-5805. We are streaming live. No, you heard that. What are your thoughts before we even dissect it? There's so much to unpack this week. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. Look, these aid workers were hunted down. This was no mistake. And I think after 6 months of this genocide, it is impossible to take any attempt to say that this was a mistake seriously. The number of UN aid workers who have been killed by Israeli forces in Gaza over the past 6 months is the highest in the organization's history. So we know that as a matter of policy, as a matter of pattern, Israel has been targeting aid workers. It has been killing doctors and nurses and journalists and humanitarians. It happened that these aid workers who work for the World Central Kitchen are international citizens, or at least most of them. There was also their Palestinian colleague. They gained a lot of attention because the head or the founder of WCK is a celebrity chef. And so that created its own momentum, which is good and bad at the same time, because it also reminds us of the kind of inequality that the Western governments afford to lives of different colors, of different creeds. And the sad truth is they considered the lives of those six aid workers heroes, all of them. And, you know, they are mourned by everybody who worked with them in Gaza. But still, their deaths came at the heel of the killing, the slaughter of more than 32,000 Palestinians, at least 10,000 missing under the rubble. None of those deaths created as much attention as the killing of the WCK convoy aid workers. I like to look for the ray of hope in all of that and say perhaps we can hope that their death won't go in vain, won't be in vain, that maybe that kind of racism, if you will, will help stop the killing.
indeed. It is that racism, and we have to talk about that racism. One of the things that became apparent to us, certainly the team, you know, I'm just the host of Borderline. There's a host of us, the host of people behind, was we were trying to book the time, right? Mm. Trying to fix the time, because we know that British summertime they had sprung forward. So my boss checked, she checked Israel, she checked Palestine, and then she came across that Israel was totally different. Israel changes their time the same time as Europe, and Palestine changes their time 2 weeks later.
Yeah, it creates a lot of chaos. But yes, that is true. Israel does attach itself to Europe and the West a lot more. In fact, ever since it began this genocidal war, it kept saying, Israeli officials kept telling the world that this is a war on behalf of Western civilization, that you need to support Israel in killing and slaughtering Palestinians on an industrial scale, because that's the only way that the West can protect itself, which is, you know, ironic, given the fact that Israel continues to say that it is part of the Middle East. It wants to have normal relations with the governments and the peoples around the Middle East, except, of course, the Palestinians, those it wants to annihilate. But there is very little effort done to kind of fit in the Middle East, except as an aggressor, except as someone who usurps land, denies rights, and kills with impunity. That's just the sad and ironic fact of it all.
Al-Shifa was on the siege again last week. Mm. I mean, just last week, the week before 7, again, I repeat, and that's not to make light of their death, of course. You know, it's one of the things that I've always wanted to do personally, is to be a humanitarian worker, even if it's for 3 months or 6 months. One of the things that I've always wanted to do. So I'm not making light of it, but 7 humanitarian workers are killed by Israel deliberately, as the world has since identified. Al-Shifa was under siege for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And the world wasn't outraged. It was hardly reported. Some 300 or so people were killed. People could not identify their loved ones. They had to identify them through the clothes. The journalists on ground literally said, "We can't show you what we're seeing."
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the scenes from Al-Shifa are absolutely apocalyptic. And it's not just the compound, which is the largest health compound in Palestine, by the way, not just in Gaza. It represented 30% of the health sector in Gaza before this war. And it has been completely, utterly reduced to charred rubble. But the whole area around it, the neighborhoods, the homes, they were pummeled. People had their homes burned while they were inside. And if they were lucky to escape the fire, they were fired upon or crushed by Israeli tanks. I've seen pictures, God knows, I would love to unsee from that siege. And the truth is, I don't think we will ever know the full scope of the horror people lived for over 2 weeks. The hunger, the torture, the taunting, the fact that people have found bodies who had still their hands and legs tied, executed. They were helpless. The doctors who were killed, there was one doctor, Ahmed Maqadma, whose mother is also a physician. They were both executed. And their only crime was the fact that they wanted to stay on and help the helpless, help the injured who could not leave Al-Shifa. They couldn't walk out of there. There was nobody to wheel them out of the hospital, and there was nowhere for them to go. And those two doctors paid for that selflessness with their lives. So I think it will take us months, if not more, before we know the full scope of the depravity of the crimes and horrors that took place there. And as you said, it barely made headlines, because it was easier to parrot the Israeli line, to treat it as credible, even though the Israeli army has lied multiple times about Al-Shifa Hospital and other hospitals to excuse carrying out such atrocities. And to, you know, dismiss all those civilian deaths as people who died tragically. You know, no mention of who killed them, no mention of who starved them.
That reality, that the reality of hypocrisy, that, you know, anybody, any one of us who has ever felt, okay, you know, yeah, there are bad people, but overall, you know, the world is a good place. We'll all come together against evil the way we came together against Hitler. You know, they all came together for Ukraine against Russia. This week, EU, Europe has stood for Ukraine in a way that it's never stood before, ever, for any other, since the Second World War. Europe has never come together in such a way, even though, yes, there are bickerings between them, but they've stood, you know. And here we are. You look at the kind of, this exceptionalization is what I keep calling it. It's beyond apartheid. It's exception. It's like they are them. It's just them.
Yeah.
Those people, those, you know, those humans out there. I'm not even going to use the A word. Those humans over there. They're not like us. They're not, and it's that hypocrisy, that really deep and undeniable hypocrisy. What do you say to that?
It is very demoralizing, but I think what's important and what this genocide in Gaza has done is also show the very deep divide that has been created between the governments in the West, who have adopted spineless and hypocritical positions toward this, some even being complicit in these crimes that are committed, and the general public. An overwhelming majority of international public opinion, of people in Germany, in Britain, in the United States, in France, all of them want an end to this war. They want accountability for the crimes. They want their governments to stop arming Israel. They want the law to apply to everybody equally, because that's how it should be. And I think the governments and the mainstream media, for that matter, are finding it very difficult to adjust to the fact that their viewers, their publics, their constituents do not agree with this warped, upside down view of the world, where the value of life is attached to the color of skin or the color, the pigmentation of the eyes. That is, I think, something that is very positive that we should, you know, hold on to and work with. And I think the kind of solidarity we've seen, led by the Global South, and good for us for doing that, to show that this international system has to work for everybody or nobody at all. I think that is going to create changes down the road. It's a strategic shift, in my opinion. It will take time to kind of bear fruit. But in the end of the day, governments, I think, and politicians, especially those who need elections, who need votes,
indeed,
are having to rethink what they're doing, what they're saying, and the kind of racism that, you know, informs many of the policies that was normalized. It was, up until very recently, it was okay to talk about Palestinians as a demographic threat, to talk about them as people that need to be contained and controlled and need to be, you know, to give assurances that Israel would be secure and that all of the things that it's doing in contravention of international law can be ignored because they're the good guys, right? They're the ones who look like us in the West. I think that, you know, ordinary people around the world, around Europe and the United States, have told their governments in very clear terms, you know, not in my name. I'm not a hypocrite.
Indeed.
And I'm not going to allow you to use my tax money and my voice to say that I don't view all lives as equal. And I think that is the one hope that we can hold on to, the one positive development that we can build on as a humanity to make sure that policies are adjusted and hypocrisy is reduced as much as possible.
Muslims in the U.S., were invited by Biden to iftar. Yes, I know. I know, eat beggars believe, but yes, they were. And the majority of them said, no, I'm not eating with you. I'm not breaking bread with you. One of the doctors who went actually said, after he told them, please don't bring any food, I'm here to talk, told him, gave him a piece of his mind, told him how he felt, and walked out. I mean, who walks out on the American president, only a Muslim Palestinian? He walked out. I know how it made me feel. How did that make you feel as a Palestinian?
Well, I was proud. This is a doctor who stayed true, not just to his Palestinian heritage, but to his, you know, the values he holds dear as an American citizen, as a doctor, as a human being. And I think that message kind of shook the White House and gave it a very, very important reality check. And the fact is, I think more and more the White House, this Biden administration, is understanding and realizing that it's not just Palestinian Americans and Muslim Americans who are angry at him for being so complicit in this genocide, for being so apathetic to Palestinian suffering. It's everybody on the left. It's his base. And you see that in the non-committed movement, in the Democratic Party primaries. You see that in the rallies organized by Jewish Voice for Peace and other allies for justice, because these are universal values. And what he doesn't understand is that the people in the trenches, on the ground, actually believe that these are universal values, unlike him and his administration. So I think that moment in that, you know, iftar, which wanted, you know, it was a photo op opportunity that basically was canceled. It was a good rude awakening. And election is upon Biden. He needs to decide what is worth more, being complicit in genocide and going down in history as Genocide Joe, or actually turning around and adopting a policy that is far more in sync with his Democratic base. We'll see. I still don't see him fundamentally changing his policies, but certainly he is scrambling along with his aides to kind of look better, sound better, and maybe even, you know, give Netanyahu and his government a bit of a scolding in public, because, you know,
they must,
their future is on the line.
It's interesting. We actually segue to that part where, you know, that phone call yesterday, which the whole world, I mean, it was headline news, and I was like, oh, for goodness sakes, these people speak all the time. Oh, Biden is going to speak to Netanyahu now. Okay, what came out of that phone call was actually a surprise to me and to a lot of people, that the US finally said, if Netanyahu doesn't open up the borders for more humanitarian aid and stop killing civilians, they will reconsider. It might be empty words, but they did say they will reconsider their Israel policy. Wow.
It was remarkable. But I think what happened, that phone conversation proved two very important things. On the one hand, it proved that Israel is deliberately starving Palestinians to death, as human rights organizations have said repeatedly and proved repeatedly. It also proves that that Biden could have, 32,000 Palestinian lives ago, picked up that damn phone and told Netanyahu in no uncertain terms that he will not tolerate starving people to death. He had that power, and he chose to use it now because there are literally crossings that Israel has closed since the beginning of October that are 10 minutes away from people who are dying of starvation, malnutrition, and thirst. 10 minutes away. That's how dystopian this reality is. Okay. And so after that phone call, after that, you know, big moment for Israelis, because they understood that so much was on the line. After all, the US doesn't just provide Israel with billions of dollars worth of weapons, it protects them diplomatically, it provides them with, you know, political cover and protection at the UN Security Council and other places. It applies pressure on governments not to sanction them and so on. And for Biden to be that openly upset and demanding concrete measures not just statements, was a wake-up call for them. And so they sprung into action. They announced that the Erez crossing in the north will open and that, you know, goods will go through. They announced that the Ashdod port will receive trucks, will receive boatloads of aid, as aid agencies have been begging for months now. And I would expect that more would be announced in the coming days, because that's at least the impression that the Biden White House gave everybody. So we'll see. We'll see where that goes. But again, it shows you just how much the U.S. could have done to prevent all of those deaths from the bombings, from the starvation, and just how little, the Biden administration thought of international outrage. It took something that other governments couldn't escape. It took the killing of the nationals of U.S. allies to kind of move into a different direction. I hope that that would at least move us in the direction where people do not die. No more people would die of hunger. And time is running out. There's a very short window of opportunity to stop the looming famine right now.
Indeed. Rafa, that's the one thing he couldn't promise, though. He could look. I know you guys are wanting to talk, to know you have questions. 0700 993 993 993. Female only line is 0201 465 7190. Okay, we're still streaming live on YouTube, on Facebook. Right, I'm gonna come back to you now. No, he couldn't promise that he would not invade Rafah. He has not. Sorry, my love. He bless you.
No, don't worry. I was trying to sneak.
He has not promised that he would not invade Rafah. Yet there are 600,000 children in Rafah. That's according to James Elder, the UN guy. Children alone, 600,000. Who and what is it going to take to stop Netanyahu from going to Rafah? If Biden didn't discuss it yesterday.
Look, invading Rafah would be an absolute catastrophe, because you have 1.5 million Palestinians there. Most of them are displaced in tents. All of them are worn out by 6 months of war, of trauma, of hunger, of dehumanizing conditions where, you know, at least 400 people share one bathroom. That's in the better parts of Rafah. So, I think it will take a lot of pressure. And I think what we're seeing in other capitals will make it very difficult for the Americans not to apply even more pressure on Israel. And let me give you an example. Yesterday, 600 lawyers, former judges, and experts in the UK petitioned their government to stop selling arms and giving licenses to arms exports to Israel. Because their legal assessment, and they include former judges in the Supreme Court, is that this would make the UK complicit in potential genocide crimes and other international crimes. And then you have civil servants who work in the department that is responsible for issuing those permits, who have told their government, listen, what you're telling me, the vague assurances you're giving me about, you know, Israel not committing violations of international law is not enough, because we could be liable at the International Criminal Court, and then all of those assurances won't be good enough for us. And I think you're seeing more and more of that. And that will mean that governments will be compelled to kind of protect their own. And the U.S. can't stand completely alone in protecting Israel, arming Israel, allowing it to get away with murder. In a few days, the International Court of Justice will again hear a case involving Israel and the genocide that it's committing in Gaza. But this case is going to be against Germany for complicity in the violation of the Genocide Convention. This is unprecedented. If you had asked me 6 months ago that we are going to see international courts kind of, you know, go quickly towards accountability, at least you know, in the moral sense and the legal sense, I would have told you that's a very ambitious goal. I don't think the world is ready yet. But we are where we are. And I think anybody with any legal background understands how momentous these developments are, how alone the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court finds himself. He has so far only appeased the West and been completely silent, deaf, blind, and mute on Palestine. And even he won't be able to stay silent for much longer. So more of that will build up, and I think it will become difficult. At the end of the day, Israel depends on the West for these arms. These armed exports have to stop.
Indeed.
And they can stop. It's a legal obligation. It's a moral obligation. It is what the public in these countries want to happen. And it can happen. It doesn't have to be permanent even, for these governments. But the law should be respected, their own domestic laws. That exceptionalism we were talking about is applying to Israel. It puts it above the law and above the rules. And that should stop.
Indeed. Lines are going. I'm coming to you now. Name, where you're calling from, and question, please. Hello?
Hello. Hello, Edibaka Yusuf. Good afternoon. How are you, ma'am?
I'm very well, thank you. What's your name and where you're calling from, please?
You have to tell me, but I'm calling you from Norway today.
Okay.
I did not have cares. You see, I'm happy the world is responding now. But I think the reality was done on Biden after the Michigan Convention, Democratic Convention, the kind of reception he got there, and the, you know, indifference of people to his comeback in November election. And that was a strong signal. And many more people in the U.S. Department are already resigning because they told them that this is not what we stood for. Our respect, our integrity as a defender of human rights globally is vanishing with the kind of hating and abating you are giving to Netanyahu in Israel. Now my question is this. Benny Gantz is a World Cabinet member. He has been invited to the America. He has been invited to the UK as well. Now, yesterday, he said there must be a change in leadership contract. And there's this opportunity that, you know, Netanyahu is holding on to, that as long as the war continues, he's going to remain in power.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that anything can happen, particularly given the fact that UK and America have invited Benny Gantz, who is almost likely to be the successor of Netanyahu? And what will be the end of Netanyahu? Is he going to commit suicide or hold to account for all the killings he has done? Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Temi Tokpe. Well, I can't say whether he's going to commit suicide, and I certainly can't ask that of my guest. Temi Tokpe, are you trying to get me in trouble? But I think you heard him. I think what Temi Tokpe is he's one of our regular callers on Borderlines because he's really into the whole global politics and you can hear from what he was saying. And I think what he wants to know is with America and the UK inviting Benny Gantz, which obviously upset Netanyahu, which was a snub to him, and Netanyahu literally being put on the fire by his own people. What do you think the future holds for him?
Well, look, in terms of his coalition and the number of votes he has in the Knesset, in the Israeli parliament, Netanyahu still has a solid coalition. And so, you know, there is still very little hope for the opposition to kind of topple him democratically. I think there are a lot of people in Israel and in Western capitals who would love to see Netanyahu go. But I think so far he's proven to be a very savvy politician who knows how to survive all of this. But I think also more importantly for all of us, it's important to remember that Netanyahu is not the problem. It's not the person Netanyahu, right? It is the policies that Israel has taken over the past 30 years that have, you know, progressively gone from center to right to far right. But the fact that the world has allowed it to do that, it has allowed it to more than, the number of Israeli settlers, for example, in the West Bank has gone from 100,000 to 750,000 in these past 30 years. So Israel has been allowed to do whatever it wants, basically, to get away with it all. And I think that is the problem. Netanyahu, of course, has a lot of the blame to share because he's been prime minister for so long. But I think it's an incomplete thought when we kind of put all of the blame on Netanyahu. He's not the only problem. There isn't a single big party in Israel that adopts the end of occupation in its political platform, not even the remnants of the Labour Party from the left. All of them have abandoned the two-state formula. All of them refuse to talk about ending occupation of Palestine, ending the apartheid they've imposed on Palestinians. And that's because the world has allowed them to do that. Once we see a shift in those international positions, like we saw yesterday with the Biden phone call, then Israel will fall in line because it cannot afford not to.
The whole world, I'm going to read a quote now. The whole world knows the Zionist regime does not adhere to any of the human principles, basic rights, international covenants, and contracts. That's Raisi, Iran. And as you know, Israel bombed the Iranian embassy.
Yep.
And they are threatening to revenge. They haven't done so yet. What do you think will happen? And if they were to revenge, will the Middle East support Iran finally and come together? No.
Yeah, I think what happened is very dangerous. Bombing a diplomatic mission in another country is what Israel did. And it's a red line that hasn't been crossed before. And Israel has crossed it in a way, kind of putting the whole world on notice that it's ready to have a full-on deterioration in the entire region. And this is not the same. It's not in par with a confrontation with Hamas. Hamas is a small, Palestinian organization. Iran is a country, a sovereign state with a lot of resources, with a military-industrial complex. A confrontation with Iran is certainly something completely different. And even with Hezbollah, in Lebanon. And I think Netanyahu, in order to stay in power and in order perhaps to kind of change the narrative and to have Israel placed in a more positive light and in the light of the victim this time, the one who's being attacked by the big bad boys of Iran, is pulling everybody's leg towards confrontation. It's reckless, it's irresponsible, and it can, turn into a complete disaster for the region and for the world at large, because it will have global implications. So far, we haven't seen that Iran took the bait, but we'll see. We'll see what happens.
We will. Okay, you can call now. I know you were calling and I didn't pick up your calls. And I know some of you are probably upset by now, but yes, you can call now. Right, let's talk about you. Funny, before I even go there, the calls are coming in. One second. I'm coming to you. Hello.
Yeah, evening, it's Yogi once again.
Good evening. What's your name and where are you calling
from?
Yes,
Emmanuel.
Emmanuel, go ahead.
Yeah, first off, I want to say kudos to Iran. You know that they are able to develop technologies that knew where those things came from and specifically pointed to Israel. You know, without the support, of the Western world, Iran, was a marginalized, separated,
Oh, Emmanuel, what's happened to your line?
I'm here.
Yes, your question.
But these people, one way or the other, came together and then developed technology, that can stand toe-to-toe with the Western world. Kudos to them.
Yeah.
Now, talking about the recent opera, about the killings, of the kitchen, whatever.
WC, yes.
I know the propaganda of the Western world. I followed them when they wanted to kick at Mark Soleimani. They came and said, "Oh, this is the most dangerous man in Iraq or whatever." This is what I'm trying to drive to. People should not be surprised, about the propaganda of the Western world. They are trying to sell themselves, as good people. Yes, they are now fighting, for the Palestine people or what have you. Whereas you people, give Benjamin Netanyahu this art, to go this far.
Yeah.
So you are complicit.
Yeah.
You can't sell propaganda to person like me today, by trying to divert people's attention.
I got what you're saying. I think what Emmanuel was saying is, look, we know that the West speaks in double speech. Okay, they're the same people who give the arms, the ammunition, the bomber jets, the 500-pound bombs, the 2,000-pound bombs to Israel to kill Palestinians, and they're the same people who now want to help Palestinians or are putting themselves out as savior. Basically, what he's saying is he, Emmanuel, is no longer going to fall for that kind of propaganda.
Yeah.
Over to you.
Yeah, I think it's important.
He was talking to you, not me. So
yeah. No, I think he makes a very good point, and I think it's important to stay clear-eyed about this. And after all, politics is not, and these policies of such big countries are not about feelings and are not about the right thing. Unfortunately, they are about very cold political calculus, and it just right now it you know, they cannot afford to be completely heartless in appearance towards Palestinians. But you're right. You're right to point out and to poke them in the eye and say, you cannot claim to have a bleeding heart and to send aid to Palestinians while you're sending the weapons that are killing them in the thousands, while you're enabling the country that is starving them to death. And while, incidentally, just today, the U.S. voted against a resolution supporting Palestinian self-determination. It voted against another resolution in the Human Rights Council that calls for accountability for crimes in Gaza or in Palestine and Israel in general. And that, I think, is a good reminder to everybody where all these countries stand. It's not about what they say. It's about what they do. And until those words match the actions, then we need to call out the duplicity and the double speak and the hypocrisy, really, of that policy.
Thank you. Hello.
Yes, it's Yoga.
Good evening.
Good evening. Rapa Chukwu, my name.
Rapa Chukwu, you're calling again. Go ahead.
No, I have not called you on this.
Oh, all right. Okay, go ahead.
I'm just calling for the phone.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, regardless of the 7th October, the Bonner contention, right?
Mm-hmm.
Good. Now, we know the aggressions and the aggressive of Benjamin Netanyahu.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
like he used to say, condemn Hamas, not Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for the innocent ones, people are dying, lives are going. We are all human beings. What they are doing is, ungodly. So I'm going to ask this question. If the answer will be delivered, good. Is there no international law that can put these two warlords out of power?
Okay.
Thank you, and God bless you.
Thank you. So I think what Rapachiko wants to know is Hamas has broken... Hold on, you know what? Let me answer that one and then I'll give you a chance to answer both. Don't all be calling out once now. Please stop. Hello?
Hello, Nigerian Info.
Yes, this is Nigeria Info.
This is Babari.
Okay.
And I am calling from Abeokuta.
Oh, you're calling from Abeokuta. Wow, thank you for calling.
I'm from Abeokuta. I'm connecting from Abeokuta.
Okay.
And you see, why this hypocrisy now? Now that the UK lost some of its personnel, you know, Australia and so other European countries, this recent bombardment of bombing of their vehicles. Now, UK is now, they are saying they should ban arms shipment to Israel. But before they were not saying this, when these arms were now being used against innocent souls, the hypocrisy is too much. Then as you see, okay, there was this 2 weeks ago. You know, I asked this your guest a question. That day there was to be a vote in the UN. The US was proposing that.
Yes.
If you remember. And I asked that woman that, was he sure that US meant what they were doing? The woman, I like that woman. He laughed and laughed and laughed. He said, the way, you know, he understands this to Igbo people, that it can never happen.
Indeed.
And through about 3 minutes, during the news, Russia and China voted against that resolution. Thank so then you. I don't know what is happening. Whether you said there was another
vote. I need you to wrap up. Yeah.
Okay, I'm almost complete.
Okay.
You think, I want to ask your guest, why is this Oyibo people so hypocritic in their affairs against the Palestinians?
Thank you.
Why?
Thank you. Okay, you guys will have to hold on with the call because I need to give Noor an opportunity to at least answer. Those are two funny calls, but you understood. I think he was talking about Rama. We had Rama Zain on here 2 weeks ago. Mm. So she did say, you know, don't trust the West, pretty much. And that's what he's saying. It's like, when they say Oyinbo in Nigeria, they mean the West. Okay,
yeah.
That's what he's saying, that, you know, he knew that you can't be trying about the hypocrisy. What Trapichuki was asking was, is there no international law that can stop both Hamas and Israel from killing innocent people who are caught in between?
Yeah. I'll start with the international law bit, because I think this is a good question. And it's so easy to lose faith in the international law, in those values that are supposed to unite everybody. But also the fact of it is that any law, no matter where it is applied, whether, you know, nationally or internationally, it's only as good as those who implement it, right? You can have the best laws on the book. If the police and the courts don't apply them, and they don't apply them to everybody, then they're really worthless. If you have laws that, you know, prohibit murder, but you allow some people to get away with murder, then that law doesn't mean anything. And that's what's happening. Palestine has become the test for these international laws. It has become the test for the West that designed and wrote those laws, and for that hypocrisy that the second caller talked about. For years, they were able to get away with claiming one thing and then having policies that basically translate into something completely difficult and different. And now Palestine and the global South are knocking on the door of the Justice Palace in The Hague. And they're saying, hey, these are the laws, these are the crimes, and now it's up to you to tell us whether they apply to everybody equally. It's a crisis for the West that is not used to being held to the standards they claim to hold themselves to. And I think that's a good thing. It's not so much about trust, but it's a moment of truth. I think the people, the public opinion, as we were saying at the beginning, in the West, is on the same page with everybody, right? In the global South, the majority, I mean, not everybody, but there is a very sizable majority that doesn't accept that exceptionalism, that colonial mentality, that wants the people in the colonial club to be protected, right? That they've got each other's back. This is an end of an era, I think, that we're seeing happening, and we need to keep pushing. We need to keep reminding everybody that these are the tests that they're facing. They have a responsibility to, not fail in those tests. Otherwise, this whole system is going to burn to the ground.
Okay, finally, one final question from me, and if I can pick up one from the phones, I will. You said something a few minutes ago, which most people do not say, and I don't think people have realized, because Netanyahu is the man in the front right now. Okay, it's okay for everybody, you know, they're all calling him Setanyahu and all these other names and stuff, and he's the one in the front line. But like you said, Zionism is the problem, and the whole politics of Israel, the whole political structure of Israel, all the political parties, all of those in power, they do support Zionism, and none of them have actually stood up to say, you know what, the Palestinians have a right, let's discuss that right. So I'm going to ask you perhaps one of the most difficult questions you've ever been asked. Who can stop Israel?
History tells us that this path, this course of colonialism, apartheid, racism, and brutality has no future. And Israel is increasingly pushing itself into a corner where it's become so brutal, so dehumanized by because of the actions and the dehumanization and the brutality it exacts on Palestinians, that the world will make it choose between continuing to be a nation among states in the same club with everybody, or to be a pariah state that chooses to be rogue, to be a colonial oppressor of another people. Israel's own policies and practices, the fact that racism is so normalized, dehumanization is so normalized and mainstreamed, when you have people, you know, blocking the entry of aid to starving people, to starving kids, while holding barbecues at the gate. This is a society that is that needs to change. It needs to be shaken into change. Israel is not going to change itself. It needs to be pressured and squeezed by the world. It needs to be forced to choose. And I think we are in a moment where that can happen. It will take time. And unfortunately, it's a very unjust world, that a whole genocide that is taking place, more than 100,000 people killed, maimed, buried under the rubble and injured beyond repair, is not enough. But we are on a different path in history now. And I think the more we keep pushing, people who truly believe that all lives are equal and of equal worth, that these international laws must apply to everyone without exception, and this that colonialism does not have a place in our world today, if we keep pushing, then Israel will have to make the choice. It will have no choice but to choose. And it cannot be, it won't be able to choose being a rogue state, a pariah state on its own without support.
No, what can I say? Thank you so much. As always, you drop it like it's hot, as they say. You drop it like it's hot. You educate, you expand on our thoughts. And today, you've literally taken us from stop focusing on Netanyahu and focus on the policy. The policy is the problem, not the person.
Yeah.
Nobody has said that. And even for me, you've taken me to a different place. Nobody has said that. And that's why we always have to love to have you on this show all the time. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Time. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Thank God bless.
You too. Have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you, my dear sister. Bye-bye. Thanks.
Thank you. So I'm going to go back. Okay, Lagos, Nigeria. Barrister, you know, I've got a minute left or so. Let me just say something. Barrister Max, you said, and you sent a message, Sisi, for some time now, I have noticed that you've become a propaganda mouthpiece for Hamas and Palestine. Why not invite Israelis to your program in order to at least seem fear? History shows that Israel is not an ordinary country. And no matter the PR campaign against them, they cannot be defeated. I am Barrister Max from Ikoyi. Barrister Max, first and foremost, let me tell you, no. History does not say Israel is not a special country at all. There is no such thing in history. What it does, what history tells us, is that Jewish people, 6 million Jews, were killed by Hitler. What history also teaches us is that, you see, that resistance that is happening, that happened in Palestine.